Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Breakpoint Banter. I'm here with Michael Joyce, former player, coach. Really excited to have him on the show. Michael, how are you doing today?
How you doing, Ben? Pleasure.
Doing well. Really, this is going to be a fun conversation, wide-ranging. You've got great experience. I think it would be great if you went ahead and just introduced yourself.
Oh, okay. Well, obviously, tennis has been my life. I started very young. My dad loved tennis, and he actually built a tennis court in our house when I was about 7, 8 years old. And so I started playing real young, and I'm 50 years old now. So we're talking 43 years ago. Back then, you didn't have the podcasts and social media and so much. And professional tennis was, I was watching McEnroe and Connors and Borg and these guys. But I was, I loved tennis, and I loved the competition, competing. And all through the juniors, it was about, winning the next junior tournament the next weekend. And then when I was about 16, 17, I started thinking I could be a pro. That's kind of what I wanted to do, which is now it's a little different. You have the young kids or even the parents start to, they're born like they're going to be a pro. But for me, it was more, I love the sport. I love winning the juniors, getting better. And then I ended up winning the nationals in Kalamazoo, and I got to the final of Junior Wimbledon. And so I turned pro, and I played on tour for about 10 years. Had a few injuries. I got to 62 in the world, and I had a pretty good solid career. And then I got into coaching, and my first year off the tour, I was staying home and working with all different types of players. I was hitting some with Maria. It was 14-15. This girl, Alexander Stevenson, I worked some with her, but I was mostly kind of like hitting with them because I was only 28, 29. And then that transferred into me eventually coaching Maria for 7 or 8 years, which she became a great player and number one. And so then I kind of got thrown into being almost like a woman's coach. And then right after working with Maria, I'm done on the tour with women. I'm done traveling. I'm going to stay home. And then I got a call from a buddy of mine who worked for the Pegulas. And then I started working with Jessie when she was like just about 17. And I saw a lot of good things in her, and we got along well. And I spent a good 7 or 8 years with her. And now, it's just kind of gone and gone, and now I'm 50 years old, and I spent a couple of years at USTA, and I'm married with I have a 7-year-old daughter who doesn't want to have anything to do with tennis, which is perfectly fine with me. But I'm here at the US Open. I'm working with a young girl named Ashlyn Kruger, who's 19, and I spent a couple of years with her at the USTA. But then I haven't been with her for the last year, and now we're kind of got the old band back together. So that's pretty much been my tennis career summed up in an introduction.
You did quite well. That's a lot to sum up all at once. And you, of course, there's so much in between there. That's really great. There's so much I could really go into. I guess a spot that would really be interesting to start with, I think, is starting with your playing career. Chronologically, I think it makes sense. It had such a big impact on your coaching career, I'm sure. You won a couple of challenger tournaments. As you said, you won Kalamazoo. You won Wimbledon Juniors. You had such early success from an early age. And you beat some great players, too. McEnroe. You beat Jim Courier. You beat the guys, right? So I was wondering what was your best memory on court as a player?
It's a good question. I think, one thing that I mean, a lot of players even go through now, obviously I had a lot of success in the juniors. In the 12s and 14s, I was always like top five in the nation or something, but you had like Tommy Ho and Ivan Barron, and these guys were kind of a lot bigger than I was. David Witt, who's a good friend of mine, coaches Jesse. We're the same age. Vince Spadia, like, David Witt, Tommy Hoe, Ivan Baron were always a lot taller and bigger than I was, especially in the 12s, 14s. And then in the 16s, I started to grow some, get stronger, and then I felt like I caught up to those guys. And I felt like, I started to play a really good level at 16, 17 years old. And at 18, when I was used to winning a lot, and then you turn pro, and then all of a sudden you're losing all the time, And I mean, the players go through that now, and you go from being like one of the best players in the United States and back, get finals at Wimbledon, one of the top five juniors in the world. And then I went into the pros, and then it took a couple years for me to, I mean, I had a few injuries and things, but it also took some time for me to get used to losing all the time. I mean, all of a sudden you go to the challengers or a couple bigger tournaments, and you're losing first, second, if you got to the quarters, it's like a good week. But, all of a sudden handling that losing is tough, is when you're not used to it. So for me, it was like, I remember winning my first challenger when I was like 20, which was huge for me. It was in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. It was a 25K, and I remember winning that, and it felt great to like win a tournament again, because you're used to winning a ton of tournaments in the juniors, and then all of a sudden it seems like impossible to win a tournament. So I remember that like specifically. And then I'd play these satellites, which are now like futures, but back then you had to play 4 weeks it was basically the same as futures now, but you had to play all 4 weeks to get ATP points. So I started to win a couple of tournaments in Hawaii. They had a Hawaiian satellite, different stuff. So all of those early tournaments I won as pros were special to me, and it also gave me the confidence to know that, I'm doing the right thing. But I also dealt with a lot of, like, my friends were in college having a good time, and girlfriends, and you're playing college tennis, and then I'm thinking, oh, like, did I make the right decision? And so you have to have a really, you have to look, my family helped me, my coaches at the time helped me, and it gave me a good perspective of, all of a sudden what I ended up doing pretty well was I felt like I could beat the top players sometimes, and I could play a really high level. But as I got deep into the tournaments, especially at the higher level, I would usually get tired a little bit, or my body would break down a little more than like the Jim Courier's or Andre Agassi's or Thomas Muster's. And so I was always felt like dangerous against the top players, but then I didn't have the physical capability to go all the way, let's say. And so, back then too, we didn't have the trainers and the physios and all the extra stuff that the players have now. And also towards the end of my career, 28, 29, that was kind of normal to stop tennis then. Like now, you see the guys playing into their late 30s and women and stuff. And so, I remember pretty much. One of probably biggest special night for me was beating Jim Courier in LA Open. I was lucky enough to play well at the LA Open, which was pretty much my backyard. I grew up like 5 minutes from UCLA, and they had the big, it used to be Volvo. I mean, it changed Bubba's Volvo LA, whatever. And I always played pretty good there, which was lucky in a way, because a lot of people don't play good in front of their, all their friends and family. And even from the first time I played that tournament, I think I had my first pro win, like in qualies. I beat this guy, Mark Kyle, who became kind of like a legend on, he had that journeyman a movie, and like when I was like 15 or something. And then I beat Ronald Agenor when I was like 17, which was a big win. And then, so I always did pretty good in that tournament, which also was kind of cool, because at home, like, I felt like everybody thought I was maybe better than I was even. And then eventually I ended up beating Courier like in the quarterfinals there 1 year. I think I got to the semis, and so I had great results in that particular tournament. Wimbledon was always really special to me. I getting to the finals of juniors, and then I made fourth round in the pros. That was a big breakthrough. I think if I had a few less injuries, I had kind of like weird injuries. I fell and dislocated my shoulder, my left shoulder. And then that turned into kind of, I came back from that, but then I turned into left wrist, like really bad tendonitis. And I ended up having to have surgery in. So I had these kind of like weird injuries that I think held me back a little bit. But I was always good at persevering. And I felt like it was a good introduction to kind of my coaching career, all those years of playing. And I had to be a smart player because I wasn't the biggest guy. I didn't have like great speed. I wasn't like an unbelievable athlete, but I had good eye hand coordination. I think I was a smart player. I could figure things out pretty quick. And a lot of that was my dad. My dad had a good tennis mind and brain, and I think I made the most of my capabilities, which then transferred into my coaching career.
Amazing. You talked about confidence. You talked about like the mental side of the game. It's such a big part. It's if not just as much as the actual physicality of it. How did you deal with those losses after being a top junior player, winning tournaments left and right? How did you deal with those early losses?
It was tough. I mean, even it was tough because you start to second guess a little bit, like, is my game good enough? Is it gonna work? Is it gonna, I think that's something that players even nowadays go through. I mean, I see it a lot in the women's tennis where, some of these transitional players to juniors who win a lot in the juniors playing a certain style. And then they realize when they start to play pros or that maybe that style isn't going to work. But the thing that's tricky is you can't all of a sudden turn into something that that you're not, And so I felt like I think I had a good mixture of like coaches. I mean, my main coach that taught me my technique and was Robert Lansdorf. And from a young age, he taught me great like technique, and he taught me really good discipline. And he taught me, kind of some of the mental toughness and stuff. But then also, like, I realized, the weapons that I had I needed to find ways to take time away from my opponents, come to the net, do things that weren't necessarily how I was winning a lot when I was in the juniors. And so, I think it was partly my dad was also good at, he'd always hire these guys who were like playing at UCLA, college players or like ex-player coaches. There was one guy, Bruce Foxworth, who helped me a ton. He was a really good player for many years. And I had a lot of good advice. I don't know if it was partly lucky or it was partly just my dad was smart, but I was very good at like learning how to use what I had and also improving aspects of my game that would like be successful, let's say, in the pros. And so, that's where I think a couple of years where I lost quite a bit, but I was always kind of trying to play the right way or try to get the maximize the most out of my game. My return of serve, my taking the ball early, coming in at the right time, where I think a lot of players maybe would have been like just discouraged or so much, or they maybe weren't willing to change. Or even try to change too much. This is something that happens a lot of times where the players, okay, I play really like consistent. Now I have to play bigger, but then it's hard to find that in between. And I think, that's always a tricky slope for everybody. And I think part of the people that were around me and just part of my mindset helped me transition to become a pretty good player overall.
I know that one of the, I guess, humorous or funnier moments of probably just entertaining overall for you on court was a match in '95 in Montreal against Greg Ruzedski. I loved hearing this story. I've heard you tell it before. Could you tell, would you mind telling it again?
Sure. I remember that clear. Yeah, very clear. So it was funny with Greg because there's a backstory to that a little bit. When I was in the, I think I was a boys 14s, hard courts were at TCU and yeah, in Fort Worth. And back then, if you were like a U.S. player, like only U.S. players could play the nationals, but like the other ones, the hard courts, clay courts, like foreigners could play. And I remember my dad got a call from Greg's dad, and he was Canadian at the time, obviously. He was from Montreal and got a call from Greg's dad and had no idea who he was or anything. And Greg's dad called my dad and was like, "My son is one of the best players in Canada and he's going to play the hard courts. Would your son like to play doubles or whatever?" So we said, "Sure." So I went to the tournament and I met Greg for the first time. And we were probably both like 13. And he was a tall, lanky guy, big lefty serve, kind of cocky, like really kind of. I remember he traveled to the tournament with his like coach's like daughter or wife or something. And you know, obviously we got to know each other well. And I think we did pretty well in the tournament. I can't remember if we might have we went far, but I practiced with him a lot and then I really liked him. And you know, some people didn't like him. He was kind of a little bit arrogant and cocky and you know, a big and so it was interesting because we got along pretty well. And then obviously I played him a lot, like in the juniors. Like I played him in the I think I played him US Open Juniors. I ended up playing Wimbledon Juniors, like semifinals. At that point, that year in 91, I beat him in the semifinals of Wimbledon Juniors, is I think when he met his now wife at the time. And then he obviously switched citizenships to England. And then in those satellites in Hawaii and everything, I played him. So I must have beat him like 9 or 10 times. Like his game just fit into my game. I had a good return of serve. I think since I knew him from so young that I had a good like take on his serve. I almost not even that I could read it. I just kind of I think since I knew him, I could almost read where he liked to go. I played doubles. I think in Hawaii we played doubles the whole time. So I had a good feel for his game, and he didn't like playing me that much. And so it was actually kind of funny because I had beat him so many times that like, but then he actually did much better than I did. Like he got to the top five in the world. He made final US Open, but I just kind of had his number. And I remember, I think he finally beat me in like Seoul, Korea, and he went on to win the tournament and he won his first ATP event. And I think that was before I played him in Montreal, if I'm not mistaken. But when I remember going to Montreal, I had to play qualifying and I qualified. And then you see, you know, the draw came out and you see who's like in the draw. And I think it was his first time going back to Montreal since he was probably like 22 or something. I think he was probably top 20 or he was 30 and 20, 30 in the world. And I saw the draw and I remember telling my coach, like I guarantee you I'm going to play Greg. And I knew like the crowd were probably going to be against him. I didn't realize how much until we were about to walk on the court. But like I also knew him so well too that like I remember I told my coach that I bet you I play Greg and that's what happened. I played Greg. And I remember they were going on center court and we were both sitting there like shocked to how many people number one were there and how many people were against him. I mean, there were signs in French like "you traitor," and it was almost like they were waiting for 4 years for him to come back. And I knew him like when he got nervous, he would kind of like smile a lot and talk a lot. And I remember him making jokes like, "Oh, you're gonna have fun today." And so I went out there just kind of knowing that like he was nervous. And then I remember him getting called for foot faults and the crowd. It was the only time in my life where I felt like I played like it was almost like a Davis Cup type atmosphere, except I was American. And maybe 8 to 10,000 people were literally just like every time he'd serve and miss, they'd cheer. You know, and then I beat him. And I was like the local hero there for the next like few days. I remember every restaurant I went to, they wouldn't let me pay. I was like a national hero for like basically sending Greg back home. And it was actually pretty funny. Like, I think I made a quote after this. I forgot what I said, but I said something that they still talk about. I think I said, yeah, he was really nervous before the match, I could tell, and I don't think he was nervous playing me or something like that. I think it was the 10,000 people calling him a traitor that made him nervous. I think it was some kind of quote like that that turned out to be pretty funny, but it was true.
That is unbelievable. It's so interesting how when you go to all these different tournaments, and so like for the example, the US Open's coming up, everyone roots for the Americans automatically. It's just what happens. So yeah, if you're a traitor to your home country, you're gonna get it.
Oh yeah, I mean they really, and it was interesting because Canada, now that I've been to Canada a lot, they love their sports. I enjoy Canada, and the people up there, I mean, I've gone up there with Jessie a bunch of times, and we even would say she'd play a small 50K challenger, and the dead of winter, the people are watching hockey and they get great crowds for the tennis, and even though tennis maybe isn't like a huge sport there, they just love sports and they respect like athletes, and it was just funny how I don't think he even expected. I think he expected to have some backlash, but I don't think he expected, neither did I, the welcoming he was gonna get. And I just remember going out there and I just felt like I couldn't lose. Like there's just no way I was gonna lose that match. And now I know what it feels like to play, with the whole crowd of 10,000 people just on your back. So it was pretty fun.
It's got to be the best feeling in the world, yeah. Just playing loose.
Yeah, for sure. And like I said too, like I had a good feel for his game. So I always, especially he had such a big serve, and being able to see his serve from 13 years old definitely helped me. I mean, I always had a good return and I played well against big servers, but I almost could read his mind, which really kind of helped a lot because obviously he had probably one of the best serves of all time.
And yeah, so your playing career was amazing, and so has your coaching career. It's been a heck of a journey already. I mean, you already mentioned it. You've coached Sharapova, Jessica Pegula. You've got a chance to coach Victoria Azarenka, Joanna Konta, Eugenie Bouchard, Tomea Babos, Sofia Kenin for a little bit, and now Ashlyn Kruger. I mean, that is an amazing list of players. God, there really are so many questions I could ask about all these players. They're all different in their own way, but there's got to be something that you've seen as a coach that is there a commonality between them?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you can kind of tell early on. I think in a way, Maria kind of set the bar for me a little bit. Like, obviously, when I started working with Maria, it was pretty early in my coaching. So, I almost had this feeling with her that she was almost like a family member, like a sister, because I knew her from like such a young age. I think I hit with her the first time when she was like 9 or 10. And then I was hitting with her a lot when I was kind of like half on the tour, kind of half coaching. My mom got really sick when I was like 28. And so I was like kind of playing, kind of coaching. So I spent a lot of time like hitting with her. And then Landsdorf, she'd come out to LA. Landsdorf would call me, give her some lessons. And then I would play her sets, and obviously at the time she was 15, 6, I could beat her pretty bad. And I used to ask Landsdorf, I'd be like, how do you want me to play, or like make it close, or, and he'd be like, oh, kick her butt, she's tough, she'll, and she would fight like for a game. Like I could be up 6-1, 5-1, and she'd be like fighting just to get like any game, and she had this unbelievable tenacity. But then also, like, it was easy for me to like give her pointers in a way, like, oh hey, I can read where you're going, or you can come in on the, and it wasn't even like it was like official coaching, it was just me trying to kind of help a young player get better. And then that transferred into, kind of being her coach like full time, when she was 17. And then also I was still pretty young myself, so I could hit pretty good and I could kind of mimic some of the players she was playing. And then I found it very easy for me to kind of see the patterns, and the top players that she was playing against reminded me a lot of me playing like, 16 and under, 18 and under, like high level, like the patterns and where girls' tendencies and how to bring out her strengths. And you know, that was when she played the championships in LA. I remember she was like 17, and she had like three or four girls in her group that she had never beat before. Miskina, Kuznetsova, she had beaten Serena at Wimbledon, but there was another one I forgot, but that she really struggled again. But she really struggled with Miskina like early in her career. And it was easy for Zonareva was another one she played. But it was easy for me to kind of pick the patterns that I thought worked. And, you know, I think I got her taking the ball earlier. I got her taking balls out of the air more, kind of using like the weapons that she had developed, you know, growing up. And so the thing was, is then when I went to work with Jessie, it was kind of like she hit the ball really well. But then because of Maria, it also set the standard super high. Like I had to also, like I couldn't always compare a 16-year-old girl like Jessie, who's like, you know, ranked like 1500, who wasn't even like a top junior and played up all the time. And I couldn't sit there and say, oh, you got to be like Maria, you got to do this, this, and this. So I had to find that balance. But then I could see like she hit the ball really well. She had good power. And then I, you know, little by little also implemented the mental toughness. You know, I think, you know, Jessie, when she was younger, wasn't nearly as mentally tough as she is now. But I think I helped instill that in her, the importance of that and the belief and the fighting spirit. And it's she makes me so proud now that she's one of the mentally toughest players, because that was something early in her career that she struggled with. And I know I helped her with that a lot. And then, you know, so going into some of the other players, but also Jessie and Maria both like love to practice with me. Like, I think that's where I think I help a lot of my players. You know, practicing training can get monotonous, and you know, you're obviously doing a lot of the same stuff all the time, and you're working on different things. But because I was a player, I know how to like make practices into games or competitions. I mean, of course, you have to do, you know, certain repetitions and stuff, but like, I think I have a pretty good knack, especially with the girls, of making it fun and interesting, and having them kind of look forward to practicing and working on patterns and working on things that transfer to the matches usually pretty quick. And I know with both those girls, if you just did the same boring thing all the time or whatever, it's almost like they're too talented. You're gonna like kind of like lose them, you know. And so that. And then obviously going into some of the other girls I've coached were a little bit more veteran style or like seasoned, you know, had a lot, you know, Konta was old, a little bit older, Vika, same thing. But like I'm dealing that with like Ashlyn now, like similar. I started working with her at 15, 16. And, you know, I think for me, it's like I like the aggressive type players. I like players that like can play most of the points on their terms, trying to, you know, hit the ball with a lot of power, pace. I mean, you know, the variety and stuff is good and important. Some players play with that, but I think I'm a better coach for girls that like to come forward, take ball early, you know, stuff like that. And I think there's a combination between having that consistency, but also having that mental toughness to have belief in yourself and believe that you're going to go out there and take it to them more than, you know, waiting back to help the other girl misses and so forth. And so for me, like most of the players I've coached and had success with, I think it's a good mentality because for me, at the type of coach I am. And I really, you know, I feel like that's kind of the similarities that they all have. And I think they're all pretty mentally tough. I mean, Maria was probably one of the best fighters, competitors, probably ever in women's tennis, you know, right up there with the best. And I was like that as a player. So, I mean, I think she had that already, but I think I also helped. And then obviously with Jessie, I've seen her transform into one of the most mentally tough players, you know. And that's obviously like you mentioned before, when you get to a level where you're top 100, top 50, that extra little 10, 20%, and having that confidence and knowing what you're going to do on the big points and those type of things, I think are crucial. And you know, I've had pretty good success kind of instilling that, and that's what I hope I can continue to do with other players.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing seeing Jess break through and have an amazing tournament in Montreal. I can't even imagine how much that meant to you, which is really, really cool to see. So even your previous players still doing amazing things.
Yeah, it's I mean, in some ways, like, I know what Jessie went through, like with her injuries and the surgeries and, obviously the years of challengers and everything. I mean, especially with her background, her family and their wealth. And so, I mean, a lot of players could have given up, and she loves tennis, and she wanted to make something for herself, and she's done that times 100, so it's I'm very proud of her.
I can only imagine. And you won the Wimbledon Juniors. You also got the opportunity to be on the coaching side of someone winning a Grand Slam, multiple Grand Slams.
Sure.
Babos, I believe you also saw in doubles, but of course Maria
Yes,
Sharapova
that's right.
with singles. Tell me about that experience. Being there in the coaching box on the sidelines, that's got to be an incredible experience.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's no doubt. But the one thing, and I try to also tell this to my players. I don't know. I mean, not to like simplify winning a Grand Slam, because obviously, winning a Grand Slam for a woman is incredible. It's the ultimate, right? But to me, it's not that much different than winning like Cincinnati or Indian Wells or Miami, because you're playing 2 out of 3 sets. I think the men's obviously is, to Djokovic or Alcaraz wins a Grand Slam, you can sit there and say, oh, they played 3 out of 5 for 2 weeks and you got these incredible 5-set matches. I think a lot of players put too much emphasis on, it's like Raducanu or something. Like, yeah, it's amazing. She won US Open. She came out of nowhere. She can't qualify, won the US Open. But it also, would she have been as famous if she did the same thing and won Montreal, let's say, which is ultimately the same if you really think about it. I mean, to be honest, it's almost harder to win Montreal or Cincinnati because you don't have days off. But because it's a Grand Slam and because it's, goes down in history, it makes it, much more important, let's say. But that also can hurt the girls, which most of them it does. Like, you'll sit there, Saba. And I think the hardest part about winning the Grand Slam is the mental, like you mentioned earlier, because physically, for a woman to win a Grand Slam physically is actually easier than winning like Cincinnati or Montreal, because there you're playing 6 matches in 7 days. Grand Slam, you're playing 7 matches in 14 or 13 days. But the hard part is all that time in between. It's a Grand Slam, so you have a lot of this like extra pressure because it is a Grand Slam. So to answer your question, I don't even know if I'm answering your question, but I think like with Maria, when she won Wimbledon, it took her 2 years to win the US Open, and then it was another 2 years before she won Australian Open. And that little, and she was getting close. I mean, she got to a couple finals, semifinals. She was always like at the later stages. But I think also what hurt her for maybe winning more when she was younger was also the fact that because it's a Grand Slam, you want it so bad that sometimes you want something so bad, it actually, you don't get it always, and so it's an obviously it's an amazing feeling, but then you kind of want the train to keep going. So you're really happy for the night and the next day, a day or two, but then you kind of have to get back on the horse a few days later, which is kind of like, in some ways, you almost hit like a this huge high, but then you hit this low. And I think the players that can keep that, maintain like the losses aren't the end of the world and the wins aren't like end of the world, are the ones who have the longer careers. That's why it's so amazing, like what Djokovic or what Federer, Nadal, what these guys have done. I mean, they've accomplished everything, but obviously they like the journey almost more than the destination. And I if that makes sense. And I think that's what the great players have that, and I don't know how they get it. I don't know what separates that, but you even hear like Kyrgios, who certainly was close to winning Wimbledon. I mean, he says, "Oh, if I won Wimbledon, I would have quit," and he probably would have, to be honest. Or, but at the same time, that's what makes these other players who win multiple Grand Slams so special. They want to keep doing it. They want to keep, striving for something, and they're able to push like this match with Alcaraz and Djokovic the other day. I mean, it's incredible that, I mean, both of them are incredible, but that Djokovic is willing to endure that pain, that, it's something that you can't, as a player myself, coach, whatever, you just can't really put your finger on it. Obviously, they just love the competition and they love fighting. And I think Jessie has that now. And, even when she was younger, she had it, maybe not consistently, but I saw things in Jessie. I saw her win matches when she was down and fight and compete where nobody else saw, because it was in like the, qualifying of a challenger, first round in like a 25K with two people watching. But you can see that as a coach, and doing it on the biggest stage, doing it then, it's kind of should be in a way the same, if that makes sense. It's not, but it should be, because at the end of the day, you're on the tennis court, you got the same lines, you got, and that's the players who are able to understand that. Like, I could see Alcaraz and Djokovic, the way they were playing the other day, I could see the two of them playing like that in somebody's backyard, and they'd probably be going at it the same way. You know what I'm saying? And that's what makes it special, because that's what they're both, and that's why Alcaraz is good, and he's gonna probably be great, because you can see he just loves the battle. That's why he wasn't crying at the end because he lost. He was just gave everything he had. He even said, "I don't know why I'm crying. I'm not even that upset." But that just, and I think that's what people love about tennis. That's that one-on-one, pouring your heart out, kind of putting everything into it. And I think that's the feeling when you win, that's so special, knowing that you help them, the person, hit the ultimate for that period of time, if that makes sense.
Raw emotion, just oh,
Right.
absolutely, for sure. No, thank you. That was a great answer.
Yeah.
Raw emotion
Yeah.
just gets the best of you. Yeah,
Yeah.
it's truly something special. I never thought about the Cincinnati versus Grand Slam, I guess U.S. Open argument. That's really interesting. Do you believe women should be playing three out of 5 sets?
No, absolutely not. They no.
It's tough. It's
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd see, I mean, it's, and then there's that argument that they say men shouldn't play 3 out of 5 nowadays, and should, a lot of people have that argument too. And, to me, first of all, I don't think women should play 3 out of 5, partly because, in some cases, I just don't think physically, I think they'd have a lot more injury. Not that they couldn't do it. I mean, there's certainly players that could do it. But like, if Swiatek, the first couple matches, you'd see a lot of matches where she would win the first 2 sets. The third set would just be like a washout, or would it, girl, I don't think you'd see a lot of women coming back from 2 sets to love down. I think there'd be a lot of dead time. I don't think the body, no matter how, I mean, women are great players, but physically they're not the same as men. They'll never be. So no matter what they do, so I don't think the body's made up. I think 3 out of 5 for men is almost too much. However, I don't think you could put as much emphasis on the Grand Slams if it was 2 out of 3, because that's what also makes the greatness of Nadal, Djokovic, or these. That's what's making Alcaraz extra special, that he could, hang toe to toe with Djokovic for 5 sets. And I mean, I even at the French, when he cramped or whatever, I remember even saying, "Well, Djokovic is back. I don't know if this guy, he's amazing, but it's going to take a couple years for him to be able to go toe to toe for 5 sets." And then he did it like a month later, so that makes him special. So I think it would diminish the Grand Slams if the men went to 2 out of 3. And I think to think, I mean, they could technically say, okay, maybe the finals could be 3 out of 5 for a woman, but then, what's that really gonna prove? So one girl gets hurt and then she can't, play for another month because she won in 5. So I think they did that years ago at the WTA championships. They played a couple 3 out of 5 in the finals or something. But I don't think, I think the way it is now is just fine. Obviously, I mean, and again, to win a Grand Slam, you have to deal with a lot of the pressure. I mean, there's no doubt. I think a player feels a lot more pressure, winning the U.S. Open compared to winning even in like Indian Wells or something. But I don't think you can, I don't think. I think if you have a player like Sabalenka, who she finally won this a Grand Slam, but they're saying she can't win a slam, she can't this, she can't, but I think what was holding her back in some of the bigger matches was mentally, obviously, because it was on her back that she hadn't won a slam. But you can't really say that, she got, tired. It's more the mental of the days off and the hectic of being 2 weeks and the lead up and the build up and all of that stuff. Of course, every player is going to feel a little bit more pressure because it's more meaningful, but at the same time, I don't think you can say it's such a big difference because men 3 out of 5, 2 out of 3, it's a big difference. Over 7 matches, it's a huge difference. And I mean, even me, I struggled in 3 out of 5. I mean, I was pretty tough guy, worked hard, whatever, but at the end of the day, I lost a lot of 5-setters, or I win a tough match and then to recover and then play again, or play New York Heat for look at Jack Sock. I mean, he won Paris indoors, but I don't even know if he could ever make even a 5-setter in New York. I think he had cramped multiple times or something. So, I don't think Jack Sock, I mean, nothing against him, but I don't think he's was close to winning a slam. I mean, but he for the week in Paris and different, he got the top 10, but he didn't do it winning 3 out of 5. So it's a big difference.
Yeah. No, it's such a tough argument. I've had the exact same debate with probably 15 people of should women be playing 3 out of 5? Should men be doing 2 out of 3? It's tough.
It's tough, especially when you see a match like the other day. If I couldn't even imagine those guys playing 3 out of 5. I mean, the way they were playing the other day. But also as a player, I realized when I played 3 out of 5, I approached it a little different than 2 out of 3, in some ways. Like you'll see a lot of times, you have 2 sets to love and then you're down 4-1 in the third. I mean, you're not gonna give up the set, but you're not gonna if you lose the set, it's almost better to have a better start in the fourth than to fight all the way, try to come back. So you kind of pace yourself a little bit. Like what Alcaraz and Djokovic did the other day, they're just going toe to toe the whole time, and then they did it at Wimbledon too, to an extent. But I think the level in Cincinnati was better than Wimbledon, but I think it was also because they knew it was 2 out of 3. So there's a lot of that goes on as well. But 3 out of 5 over, I know there's arguments to that, but I think it would definitely, let's put it this way, if also with the women, that's why I think you see surprise winners more because it's 2 out of 3 in a way. The men, like for a surprise, for somebody to pop in and like win a slam and get through like Alcaraz and Djokovic and Medvedev, it's like, yeah, it's I don't think it's gonna happen because of 3 out of 5, but 2 out of 3 it could. John Isner popped, I think he won Indian Wells when so does he really deserve to be a Grand Slam champion? I don't think so because of that 3 out of 5. So that's why I don't think they can really change it. I mean, if they do, then you'd have to put, like, in my mind, you'd have to put, you couldn't put it with all the slams that Nadal won and so forth and Djokovic because it's not the same. I think most players would agree with that 100%.
Fundamentally different, absolutely. And
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
it's you watch the women play the slams and you're like they lost the first set. It's like they don't have enough time to come back. If you have a rough start, it's like
Sure.
you got it's 2 out of 3
Yes.
sets. They're used to playing
Absolutely.
that, of course, but still.
That's why I think you see more upsets in the women in slams and stuff also. Because like you said, you go out a little nervous. you could be a top seed. And girls that are the depth of women's tennis is much more than 15, 20 years ago. I don't think the top players are necessarily better than the top players, 15 years ago. I think Maria in her prime could win the US Open right now. I mean, obviously Swiatek, tell you these girls are really tough too, but I think when she was playing her best, or Hennin certainly could win the French right now. But the thing that would be tough would, I think at one point I remember going, I think the first 4 or 5 years I was with Maria, she never lost before the semifinals of a tournament, except for the French. She lost the French a couple times to Hennin, but she literally never lost before the semifinals of any tournament for like 5 years. I don't think that would happen now, because I know she got through some matches that, like, she was down, it was close. Or like Serena and Venus used to almost like play their way into shape. Like they'd show up at Wimbledon. I used to like pray they would lose early, because I knew if Maria played them in the semis or finals, they're going to be unbelievable. But you'd see Serena like struggle first couple of rounds. So like it would be tougher to do that now, because the girls that are 80 or 90 are much better than they were back then. But the top players, I think, are pretty, top 10 is pretty, like, pretty much the same. In some ways, you could almost argue that top 10 was almost deeper, top 20 was almost deeper 15 years ago. It's just like, I mean, it was a joke. I mean, you had Williams sisters, Maria, you had Kuznetsova, Dementieva, Davenport, Clijsters, Hennin, all at the same time. I mean, it's super tough. But then a girl ranked 50 was not, in my mind, nearly as good as a girl ranked 50 now, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the same thing on the men's side too. I think the game was much deeper even, 10 years ago.
I mean, the top, like, grass court players. I mean, you had like tons of good grass court players. Now you have like a handful. I mean, the same thing, the top, 15, if you look at top 15, I mean, they're all were like unbelievable. The you don't see like the dominance, let's say, of back then. You had more, but then guys 200 now are like incredible. I mean, you see men's qualifying, it's like, I mean, I watched a couple guys today, and it's like, Jesus, like, this is qualifying. Guys ranked 200, he's unbelievable. So that's the depth. Is definitely more in men, but and women. But the top players, I don't think it's changed that much. I mean, I could be wrong, but that's what I think.
Yeah. And speaking of now, you're working with Ashlyn Kruger. Would love to hear what you're most excited about for a game. You've been working with her for a while, as you mentioned, but what are you most excited for?
Yeah, well, she has a really, really, she's very athletic. She's tall. She's a strong girl, tall. I like the way she plays. Big hitter. She was great around the net. She had, I think she has a full court game. I think, she has to use, I mean, I started working with her a little bit when she was like almost just about 16, and I could see right off the bat, like, I liked her tools. And then, I worked with her pretty much full time for a couple years. She was very like young and naive, and also you have to realize too, with the pandemic, some of these younger players, I don't want to say they missed a year or two, but they didn't totally miss it, but it definitely held them back a little bit, with all the lack of tournaments and traveling and experience. So I remember taking her to like French Open Juniors and Wimbledon Juniors. It was the first time she'd ever been to Europe. French Juniors was the first time she ever played on red clay. They actually had the bubble, so they were keeping the junior players and the pros separate, which was, that was one of the big things, even when I was younger, of playing the junior French in Wimbledon, was kind of being around the pros. Even sometimes the pros would ask you to hit or warm them up, or that was part of the experience of the juniors, which thank God we're back to that. But those couple years, it was, she had the experience of playing Wimbledon, but we couldn't even go, like, she couldn't even like go walk around. I mean, it was just like, And all the juniors dealt with that. So she, in my mind, she's a pretty young 19-year-old in some ways, and she's this last year I haven't been with her. I left USTA, and it's tough when you first turn pro. She doesn't have that much money, and so forth. And I was doing other things, but I was always the coach that she had did a really good job, and I was helping him a little bit with her on some stuff. But like, I feel like, especially with the mindset that Jessie had, Maria had, I feel like if she can stay healthy, and she can keep working on those weapons and building the confidence that she can play the tennis on her terms, I think she could be like a Rybakina or close to it. I don't see why not. And she's a fast learner, and so I'm excited about the future. And obviously she trusts me, and we're close, and I think that's super important too, because you spend a lot of time with your player and coach, and you're on the road a lot. And like, after you open, we're gonna go to Asia, and it's gonna be her first time there. And it's with Jessie, same. I took her to Asia like when she was 18, 19, and it's different. I mean, that's one thing too, when you're a pro player, when you're a junior, you're even a college player, you're used to playing in the comfort of your own country and eating, food you're used to, and some being on the road, traveling, handling a loss, and then you don't have a tournament for a week, but you got to keep getting better during that week. That's where a lot of players, when they don't have coaches, it's easy to kind of, fall into, oh, you lose, you take a few days off, and then you warm up a couple players, and then next thing you know, and then you're maybe on the tour for a year or two, but you're not really, you're playing matches, you're gaining experience, but you're not working always like the way you should. I mean, I think a lot of players, so I think if she continues on the path of an improvement, that she can do big things. You just never know when it's going to happen. It could happen at any time. So I'm excited about that.
High praise, Rybakina. And yeah, she definitely has the physical attributes very similar to her. So that'd be pretty cool, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you don't know. I mean, I saw Rybakina a few years ago, and you can tell, but I mean, she, I mean, now she's one of the top players in the world. But it's similar type game, and I think she's got to play kind of similar style. Everybody has their own styles and stuff, but I've had good success with that style, and I think she's capable of doing it. And like you said, the mental and the confidence, and believing in yourself, and believing that what you're doing is going to pay off. And yeah, I think that keeps you going. And I think it's, that's the beauty of also why I like coaching women's tennis too, because I think a coach can make a really big impact. Not that a men's coach can't, but sometimes the men, I think in some ways men sometimes might be limited. Even I see like a guy like Dan Evans. I mean, to me, a guy like Dan Evans is incredible. I think he's absolutely incredible. I mean, he does everything amazing. But is he going to win a slam? Is he going to beat Djokovic? Is he going to beat Alcaraz? I don't even know what I would really tell him to do that. He might beat him on a day, but you know what I'm saying? It's like, or like, Isner's not, he's getting older, he's not playing as more, but like, you could do everything perfect and go out and play John Isner, and you just can't read a serve, and you just lose two tiebreakers or something. I think in the men, sometimes some things are out of your control, where I feel like the women, you can make a big impact quick, and you can, I think it's a little bit more even playing field, if that makes sense.
Outside of tennis, you're also involved with some really, really cool stuff. There's a app you're involved with in some way. I'd love to hear more about it.
Oh yeah, so yeah, that's something that's come up kind of new last few weeks actually. But it's funny because as a coach too, a woman, especially women's coach, I mean, you always hear about, tennis, first of all, right now is like the, I think it's like, it's been proven it's like the biggest bet, like people bet on tennis more than like all sports combined or something. Partly because, you have individual matches going on simultaneously all over the world. And I think, I mean, especially in other countries, players can, I mean, people can bet on like every match. I mean, even UTR tournament and so forth, and challengers, futures, everything. And so what a lot of the players get, they get a lot of nasty messages on social media, and they get a lot of you hear about it. Swiatek mentioned it even like a week ago. She lost the first set and she was getting nasty stuff. And obviously you can block, those people, you can block stuff to an extent, but then they just sign up for another account or they get you somewhere else. And some players handle that fine. They're just like, whatever, it's no big deal. But a lot of players, especially the newer players and even women, I think are affected by it maybe a little bit more than men in some ways. They talk a lot about how they look, or they're fat, or they can't, whatever. And the thing is, even when you block it, you see it. Maybe you see something and then you block it out, whatever. But it goes in your mind. And I feel like I've mentioned the last like 10 years or so, I'm like, I think it's hurt a lot of players. It's hurt their self-esteem. It's hurt. And then you say, okay, we'll just get rid of social media. But then social media is also a huge part of their endorsements. In advertising, all of that stuff is important, super important. So I know this girl since I was younger. She actually played tennis. She lives in Australia now, and she her colleague has a an app, especially with the AI or now they can do it. And he was like head of Homeland Security in Australia for 10 years, and he developed this app that you can put on your phone, and there's eight big football teams in Australia that are using it, and the players and their families have it. And so if somebody writes something or says something nasty, once it hits your page, it just disappears. And eventually it's called Social Protect, and you can actually look it up on it's on the App Store, but you need a special code to put on your phone. And so it pretty much protects all, like you won't see any of that stuff if you have it. It'll never hit your page, or if it hits your page within 1 second, it's taken off. And then the guy can actually, it goes into some kind of vault, and eventually he's going to be able to even see who's kind of doing this stuff. And so I think it's going to put an end eventually to all of this bullying and social media type abuse. And they're trying to get it out there, and he developed it because he has a couple teenage kids, and the suicide. I mean, mental health is obviously such an important part of everybody's life, and the tennis players, just like other sports stars and whatever, they're dealing with a lot of stuff on their social media that they don't want to see, that they don't need to see. And this is something that I think is going to help get rid of that. And so I'm trying, I have a few players that are trying it out to see if they like it. And then we've also offering it to some sports teams or colleges for free the next few months to kind of try it out. And so I'm trying to kind of get the word out there, and little by little, hopefully that will be a thing of the past eventually. But that's definitely something that I'm trying to work on along with. And then I also have a website. I broke my leg 6 months ago, which was crazy. I was hitting a showing a kid how to hit a forehand return, and my leg buckled, and I was on crutches for 3 months. It was terrible. I'm still feeling the effects. I can hit. I can feed balls, I can serve, but I still can't play full out, or and I'm still in the process. And so it gave me also an opportunity to do some stuff online kind of for the first time. So there's a few players that I'm helping out a little bit. Like obviously I can't, I mean there's tons of coaching online, but this is more of like a, it's called Michael Joyce Tennis. It's a website, and you can go on the website and And now with videos, I can watch some of their matches if they're juniors, some of their practices. I can be in touch with some of their coaches and offer different drills and stuff. And so it gives me a way to kind of consult with some of the coaches and their players. But that's something new for me as well. And you know, it's kind of, I'm trying to kind of get into some of those things because that's obviously a big part of our lives now. And sometimes I feel like I'd like to be in five places at the same time, and realistically you can't. But nowadays with the phones and the, you know, videos and stuff, I think I could reach a lot more people and than I could before. So I'm trying to kind of get into that a little bit, and so it's fun. That's so those are a couple projects I'm working on the side a little bit.
Really cool stuff outside the coaching. I mean, Social Protect sounds amazing. You're gonna save, as you said, the mental health of top athletes. It's gonna be amazing to be involved in.
Some of those football players or rugby or Australian rules, I think it's called, some of those guys were actually not on social media at all because they didn't want, like, you know, it wasn't like they were that upset, you know, if some guy calls you a jerk or whatever, it's not like the end of the world, but they kind of were worried about their families, or you get these like threats, like, you know, I'm gonna kill your family because you fumbled a football or whatever. And so they just kind of like just took themselves off. But what was happening was it's costing them money because a lot of the companies want to know, you know, have this social media. And so what the teams have found out is by having this, they're actually making a lot more money because they, you know, they pay a fee or whatever for their team and their play, the family to have it. But then whatever it costs for the whole team, you know, 500 people, it might be 8, 10,000 a month, whatever. But then the teams actually and the players are making a lot more money because now they can be on social media, they can promote themselves, the projects and so forth, and they just don't even have to worry about that. So it's actually, and then eventually, like in January, I think you can just go on the App Store and you could download it, and it's going to be like basically cheaper than like a subscription to Netflix, you know. So I think it's a no-brainer for even like, I have a daughter who's 7, she doesn't have a phone yet, but I'm thinking, you know, down the line, I mean, the fact that people can reach you any which way, you know, is great, but it's also could be a curse, you know. And so this is something that I think could really help, you know, not just the athletes, but ultimately a lot of that online bullying and so forth that we hear about, could hopefully become a thing of the past because, you know, this is, the phones and the, you know, the social media, all that, everybody has it, has access to it. It's a huge part of everybody's life now. And the lady who I know who's got me involved in this, she's very big into mental health. She has one of the biggest podcasts in Australia on mental health, and she was saying like suicide, teenage suicide rate is like 100 times more than it ever was the last, you know, so many years, and it's all related to that. So I think it's a fun project because I do know how much it's affected. I have some kids or younger girls who I've coached who don't really know what that is until they play their first pro tournament, and then all of a sudden they go on their phone and they have like 50 horrible messages, and they're like, you know, what the heck is this? You got girls like Jessie, and these girls are kind of used to it, and they've been dealing with it for 10 years. I mean, you can imagine the abuse and stuff that Jessie's got, and not just with her tennis, but like with the football team and the hockey, and then, you know, she's gotten kind of used to it, and she kind of laughs it off, and she, you know, it's not, and she's been able to handle it, but also it's new for a lot of people are dealing with it all the time, and you know, and girls especially in some ways I feel are even hurt by it even more because, you know, they care a little bit more about what they look like and so forth in some ways. So I just think it's a great thing, and to me it's like should be a no-brainer as time goes on. It's just, and it's obviously just like the beginning, and those teams in Australia have had huge success with it, and they love it. So I'm trying to bring it to the United States and other parts of the world. So I'll see how I can do it, but it's exciting for me.
An amazing mission. Absolutely. That's really exciting. Michael, thank you so much for hopping on this call. Really enjoyed chatting, learned a ton, had a great time. Just want to wish you best of luck with you and Ashlyn. I know she got a wild card at the Open. Very, very exciting. Excited to watch that match. And yeah, thanks so much and have a great rest of your night.
Thank you, Ben. Hopefully I'll see you out there in person in at the Open.
That'd be great. I'm gonna head over there for sure.
Yeah, come say hi for sure. Thank you.